and welcome to Hidden Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Ravenna Lipchick, who is one of the violinists of the Overlook Quartet based in New York City. She also is currently studying historical performance at the Juilliard School. In addition, she is a member of ACME, or the American Contemporary Music Ensemble, also based in New York City, and we'll be talking about bouldering. Welcome, Ravenna. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yay! Hi, Patty!
Hi! Oh, it's been a long time coming.
To be here.
Yeah!
I know!
So yeah, we are past chamber music colleagues. Well, not obvious, obvious to us.
Yes.
We met at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music during this wonderful few years, and we actually were in a trio together with our other colleague, Jung-un Lee, and we were called Trio 507. And
I was just going to ask if you remembered the number, because I couldn't remember the number.
Yeah, 507, because that was the rehearsal room that we practiced in all the time. And I learned so much from that group. And specifically the Ravel piano trio and the Ghost trio and a little bit of Horensky.
Yes.
Those are some of my fondest times, like rehearsing and working with you and Jung.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think about it very often.
Yeah. The other day I actually pulled out, I was noodling and just kind of warming up, and I pulled out the Ravel piano trio. I was like, I wonder if I can still play this. But it came back to me very quickly. I was like, oh, well, you know.
We learned the choreography of that piece.
Totally.
Really well.
That's a really great way of putting it, actually. Yeah. Choreography. That,
especially for you, with your cello going all the way up.
Yeah. It is
so
delicately
scary and beautifully. Oh, I always go back to the da 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 da. Because that's just, I still have so much residual baggage.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Totally.
It's one of the most beautiful moments in music, mm-hmm. and also one of those ones that's like you never feel that you can do justice.
Oh, yeah. But you always did. Oh. I'll give you that affirmation on my end.
Because I had your little pits. Da-da-da-dee-da-da. Pits. Dee-da-da. Sending me back down.
Well, that was Ravel. Anyway, so clearly we got to know each other very well. We also did some competitions together. One of my favorite memories, though, is after we competed at Plowman Chamber Music Competition, you ordered Insomnia cookies. Do you remember this?
No, but it's on brand, so I believe you.
Yeah, it was my first time I've ever had Insomnia cookies. And I just remember you like, I just need some cookies right now. And it was just this giant box. It was great. It was everything we needed.
Also, because Plowman was in Missouri, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we were like, what do we do here?
Yeah. Sorry, Missouri. But you're not wrong. There was not much to do around the campus. Yeah.
You eat cookies.
Yeah. No, it was great. Yeah. Anyway, just how we met. And I respect you so much. And I consider you such a wonderful colleague in person.
Aw, thanks, Patty.
Yeah.
Back at ya.
Aw, thanks. All right, what is your most insane performance story? I hope I'm not in the story.
No, you're okay. Not. Good. I think that I've had a lot of exciting performance situations. Nothing that crazy has ever happened to me in a performance.
Oh, that's good.
Well, I was looking back, and maybe the most ridiculous thing was in high school. I was a freshman in high school, and our theater department was invited to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and we were doing Candide, mm-hmm. and we were bringing a small group of us, so we all had to play multiple roles. So I was like playing a sheep here and a narrator there, but I was also playing the violin, mm-hmm. and it was me and our music director, Mrs. mm-hmm. Perkins, who played the piano.
Okay.
And she just gave me this piano score, and I was playing the violin to Candide. But on our like third show, I left my music in the hotel. Uh-oh. And then just decided to play it all for memory.
Oh no.
Which I did.
Oh, okay.
And I think it was one of those things that could only happen because of my youthful ignorance.
Sure. Well, and also,
I was just...
But the thing is, I was also going to say, I feel like when I was that age, I had everything memorized. And it was only up until my later years in school that I feel like my RAM in my brain just was like, ran out of gigabytes. Like, I couldn't remember everything.
Enough.
And now I just play it off of music all the time, if I can.
Well, yeah, that's wildly preferable. But you're right. You're right. And they're also, I mean, my attention span was better.
Sure.
Right. I didn't have a cell phone back then.
Right.
You know, what else was I going to do but
memorize
Candide?
Wow, I'm glad that it was successful, though.
Well, I don't actually know.
Oh.
Because in my 14-year-old brain, I was like, yeah, I did that. But I have no idea what it sounded like in the audience.
I'm sure it was fine, but if it wasn't, probably people forgot by this point.
Oh, I'm 100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So that was kind of an insane thing. And then the other one was when I was living in San Francisco, I got a call to play a wedding, and it was like a VIP client, so we weren't allowed to know who it was. You may already know this story.
I might. It sounds...
Yeah, you might know this. Yeah.
Go on, though. Remind me.
And I'm like moaning, and we're all complaining because it's like an hour and a half out of the city in some vineyard, and we're like, oh gosh, okay, I guess we'll drive there.
Yeah.
And we get there, and they make us go through this servant's entrance, and we're like, what is this treatment? Just, you know, like, so just high and mighty and full of ourselves in our youth. So we're setting up, and I'm looking for the officiant to ask for the final words in the ceremony, whatever. And he goes, oh, yeah. It's going to be, ladies and gentlemen, I now present to you Mr. and Mrs. Robin and Susan Williams.
Right.
And we were like, huh? What? Like,
did I hear that right?
No way. Like, it has to be, as a coincidence. It's a coincidence.
Yeah.
So we're setting up, looking around, like, what the fuck? And then George Lucas walked in front of us to go take a seat. And we were like, okay, this is happening. This is real.
Robin Williams is, yeah.
Yes. So ended up playing for Robin Williams's third and final wedding. And we hung out. We played the ceremony, which was maybe 20 minutes. They had booked us for 8 hours.
Wow.
And they were lovely. They were like, oh yeah, help yourself. Seafood buffet. Have a martini. Relax. And like, maybe in like another hour and a half or so, if you want to play another 20 minutes.
Like, go for it.
Oh. It was wild. So we're like drinking martinis, playing Haydn quartets. And after every movement, Billy Crystal and Robin Williams are saying, ah, bravi, what was that? What was that? And we're like, well, it's still Haydn. And they go, ah, the classics. Just like the best audience you could hope for.
Yeah, exactly.
And the best reception for a Haydn quartet.
Oh my gosh, that's hilarious. I wish I was in that gig. That sounds awesome.
Oh, I know. Well, I don't think you were at school.
I don't know.
I don't think you were there yet. That's what? So funny.
It's always fun to hear those, like, really, you know, weirdly celebrity-esque stories. And also that they were really nice people and appreciated your music.
Right.
Yeah.
And the fact that they had hired local students to play their wedding. He could have paid to have anybody play.
That's true.
And I remember even living in the city, the stories on Halloween, like kids who trick-or-treated in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
He was lovely.
Yeah.
He was a part of, like, really, like, a true part of the San Francisco community.
Yeah. Oh. R.I.P. I hope you're doing better.
R.I.P.
Robin Williams. Okay. Well, thanks for sharing those stories. Yeah. They're always fun to hear. So anyway, I'm curious. You mentioned that you fostered puppies during the pandemic.
Yeah.
How did you get into that?
Well, I grew up with dogs and cats, so I like having a pet. But pre-pandemic, obviously, my schedule was totally unpredictable as a freelancer. You're going week to week, month to month.
Mm-hmm.
And just never thought it was fair to have an animal.
Yeah.
I had a couple fish, but, you know.
I mean, they're fish.
Can only get so much.
Totally.
So I did get emotionally attached, to be fair. Yeah. There was bonding, but it's just not the same.
Yeah.
So I assumed when the pandemic began that it would be like, oh, this is a month or 2 months, you know, as we all did.
As we did, yeah.
So it's like, what a perfect time to just temporarily take in a dog. So I started with one, and I had him for a month and a half, which was the beginning of the pandemic, so nobody was going anywhere. It was really hard to get him adopted.
Sure.
But he did get adopted by the barista at my local coffee shop.
Oh, very cool.
So now she and I are really, and we're still really good friends. She lives 2 blocks away from me.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So then I kept fostering. Because a friend of mine was saying, you know, everybody jokes about foster fail. You foster your first animal and you get so attached and you can't bear to part with it.
Sure.
But really then you're just closing your home for another animal who's in need, a transition. Mm-hmm. You really are acting as a bridge for this animal.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think a lot of people who adopt don't realize is that the foster parents are the ones who really get the dog settled into living
in the home.
In an apartment.
Yeah.
In a home.
Yeah.
There's basic training involved. There's just a lot of sort of comfort and soothing. Because a lot of the dogs I was working with came from kill shelters
dog
fighting rings. I know.
Oh,
I wanted to foster dogs who were really, really in need. Not, you know,
good for
just
you.
A cute puppy.
Yeah.
So a lot of them are sick. They come, they drive them up in a van from Georgia, where they, like, they're just in a crate the whole time. And
oh, poor puppies.
So it's, I know, it just, it breaks your heart. And then you see them grow into their personality and become, and you think in the moment, you're like, oh, no one could possibly love this dog as much as I do.
Yeah.
But when you see them meet their forever people,
yeah,
all of a sudden it clicks.
Yeah.
And you realize, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, it's incredible. Yeah. This is where the dog is meant to be.
Right.
It's, yeah. It's a great feeling.
Oh, that warms my heart so much. And like, it's also like, I totally see how you would be such a wonderful caretaker for these animals. Like, I know you as an empath. And so it's like, oh, such great work. Good job.
Oh, thanks. It was nice. I needed to not think about myself. For a little bit, too.
Sure.
You know.
Well, are you ready for some spitfire questions?
I'm ready, Patty.
Okay.
Bring it on.
Okay. Mahler or Bruckner?
Mahler.
Debussy or Ravel?
Debussy. I know. I don't know where that came from.
I mean, it's hard to choose. I just thought...
I'm going to commit.
Okay.
I think the soundscape of Debussy feels more like home to me, mm-hmm. even though I really appreciate the cerebral aspects of Ravel.
Yeah.
I don't need to explain myself. It's a spitfire round.
Fair enough. Cats or dogs?
Dogs.
Appetizers or desserts?
Both. Can I say both?
Okay, if you only have enough money to choose one.
Patty, you're killing me. With food, I can't. Okay, I'm going to go with my mood right now. I'll say desserts.
Okay. Sparkling or still water?
Still.
Fan favorite question. Alternate universe musical instrument?
Cello.
Okay, yeah. I see that.
I know. It's so lame.
What?
No. Not the cello's not lame. It everybody has cello envy. There's nothing new there.
That's true. Fair point.
Truly alternate universe, tenor saxophone.
Oh, what the? Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I have too much PTSD from our competition days. For to like.
Oh, I know. Always getting beaten by these
saxophone quartets. Yeah.
Jeez. Man, it's a good thing you told me not to swear at the beginning of this, because you're bringing up all these feelings. I'm having to work really hard.
Okay. I'm sorry.
Just to play jazz, just to clarify. Sure. I wouldn't want to play classical.
That's fair.
Jazz.
I'll take that. Acceptable.
Thank you.
Early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
Okay.
Actually, that's a recent development.
Is it from the pandemic?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. And being old now.
It does change you, doesn't it? A little bit.
Yeah. I'm not trying to be at school till 11 p.m. practicing.
Right.
Nah. I'm trying to be in bed by 10:30.
Right.
And wake up and have a day.
Yeah. Pandemic guilty pleasure?
I don't think I consider any of my pandemic pleasures guilty.
Okay. That's a really good point to point out in my question. Is that no one should ever feel guilty about anything they did during the pandemic, but
yes.
Something that you did in the pandemic that you don't normally do. Let's put it that way.
Okay. You know, I think I still do everything I did.
Oh.
Like, okay, so for example, the thing that I started doing in the pandemic that I had never really done before, baths.
Okay.
Taking baths.
That's a good one.
Well, there's more to it. Am I allowed to elaborate?
Yeah, sure.
So I would pick an album that had been recommended to me or I'd wanted to listen to for a while, roll myself a little joint, get in the tub, smoke my joint, listen to the album.
Oh my gosh. That sounds amazing.
It's the best. And I obviously I'm not doing it as much anymore because things are back and I'm more busy, but
that's a good tradition to hold on to.
Yeah. It's a great one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's like a life goal. All right. Favorite professor shout out.
Okay, well, I mean, Ian. I gotta say Ian.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Swenson, Mark Sokol.
Yeah. I mean,
obviously.
I knew these answers were coming. But
yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean,
those were our coaches too, frankly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I spent more time with Ian and Mark than I did with Axel.
Yeah.
Shout out to Axel.
But I mean, Axel's great too. Yeah.
Love Axel.
Yeah.
Love them all. Honestly, I want to name the entire SFCM faculty.
Of like that particular
time. When we were at school.
Oh, I know.
Of that time.
Yeah. It was incredible. Yeah. I know. I've always talked about how incredible it was, but like truly it was like such a unique moment to be at that school.
And to have all of those, Jean-Michel, Jennifer, Jody, Bettina, Paul, Yoshi. Mm-hmm. You know, like working together.
Yeah.
Yes, there were always egos involved, but they never lost sight of
the true meaning of what they're trying to.
Yeah.
They all agreed that teaching was their passion.
Yes.
Yeah. And they just had different ways of approaching that.
Yeah. But there was respect.
Totally.
For the different approaches.
Right.
Which is something I've encountered in micro doses. Mm-hmm. For example, Mr. Copes at Juilliard mm-hmm. for my modern masters was always, you know, very encouraging and wanting to learn what I was learning in
right.
my secondary lessons with so-and-so, right. but not the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Not like it was like with chamber class and everything and just like, yeah. And
I
know
miss that.
I miss it too. I miss Ian, but he's still alive. but of course, I've definitely in the past have talked about Mark Sokol and how amazing of a teacher and human. And I mean, of course, he's passed, but I miss him every day. I think about what he's taught me and like how he taught us. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. I talk about it even as far as communication, mm-hmm. communication of ideas, the way that I know that you and I have definitely spent hours just talking about Mark and everything.
Yeah.
But if it was clear to him that a student was not grasping the idea or the concept, he had a multitude of ways to express the same idea.
Yes.
Because sometimes all it is semantics.
Right.
Right. And it's just saying the right word to make something click in that person's brain. It's wild.
Yeah.
But he had the patience for it, and he had the vocabulary for it, and the specificity mm-hmm. of intention mm-hmm. for it.
And the drive to do it. He didn't give up on mm-hmm. any student. And everything is admirable about him, but that to me was the most admirable. Of all the things, because it's so easy for someone just to say, oh, well, they just don't work. It doesn't work. We're just not clicking or something like that. He never gave up.
Yeah.
And I think in turn, that made us not give up within ourselves. Yeah.
Right. Well, that's another thing that I really value about our time in the trio mm-hmm. is that we also held each other. I felt held accountable and to a standard.
Yeah.
I keep coming back to intention because that's really, it's a focus. Mark showed me the possibility for colors. It's like putting on the glasses when you haven't been able to see color.
Right.
Which is terrifying, but he also set us up really well to have the tools to navigate those colors mm-hmm. and really find what we wanted.
I know. Look at the gush fest over here. I miss Mark so much. Those who were able to work with him, I think, all understand where we come from. And it,
oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Anyway, let's just move on because I can just keep going. We love you, Mark.
Love you, Mark.
Most transformative performance experience?
I'm bouncing a couple around in my head. Mm-hmm. Freshman year of college, Simon Rattle came mm-hmm. to do Tristan and Isolde with us. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that I felt so deeply connected in an orchestral setting mm-hmm. enough to think, oh, okay, I want to do it. If it's this level of connection, so inspiring. It blew my mind. Mm-hmm. I think I was going straight to the airport that evening after rehearsal to fly back to Milwaukee. And I called my mom in the car. I was going to see her in a few hours, but I couldn't wait. And then Ian's recital, my sophomore year, we did the Chausson Concerto for Violin and Piano, and I was in the string quartet. It's string quartet accompaniment. Mm-hmm. That was huge. I don't know if teachers remember what it's like to be a student and being offered that kind of opportunity mm-hmm. to be in a rehearsal and performance space as an equal.
Yeah.
I mean, so much as an equal. He was still leading the show, but
at least on the same literal playing field.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. I loved the rehearsals. I loved how we dug into everything. That fed me in such a huge way. Mm-hmm. It's more like these experiences that kept fueling the fire mm-hmm. and gradually kind of solidified. Like in New York, it was doing Rameau, Les Engalants with Bill Christie was really the performance where I thought, oh, okay, this is historical performance. All right, I'm going to pay attention to this now.
Yeah.
This is really rocking my world in a,
yeah.
in a good way.
Yeah.
Like those little positive nudges down the right path.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny because I feel like I also recently had a transformative experience and I thought I wasn't necessarily going to have one again.
Ah.
You know what I mean? Like I would think that your transformative experiences are those in the past, almost like what got you down the rabbit hole of being a musician. But mine was recent with my string quartet. We played one of our Beethoven cycle concerts last Monday, for instance. And it was one of those things where I knew I don't know the next time I'm going to play Beethoven 127 or 18.1 or 59.2. So I played it mm-hmm. in a way that was I was saying hello and goodbye at the same time. And I feel like all four of us were connected in that same approach. And mm-hmm. it was a really, really fulfilling concert. concert. And it's one of those things where it's like, they do happen later in life too. Of course they do, Patty. Absolutely. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
It was just like, okay, like there's always, you know, sometimes when you become a professional musician, it's like, okay, it's work. You just go do this one gig, go to the next and do this one thing and whatever. And then, but then there's other moments where, yeah, they're like little pings of, okay, no, you're doing the right thing. Keep going.
Yeah.
And you never know really when that's going to happen.
Right. But a huge part of that is allowing yourself to stay open to that possibility.
Right.
Right. It's so easy to shut down.
Yeah.
Into the grind and the hustle.
Right.
But that's also something I always loved about working with you.
Oh.
Is that no matter what we were doing, uh-huh. you were in.
Yeah.
You were in and you were there to make it the best that it could be.
Yeah.
Thank you. Figure out how to make it. Oh, yeah. No, it was really inspiring for me. I still think about it a lot.
Oh, thanks. I mean, you're there with me too. I think we were like egging each other on. But yeah. I miss playing with you. Okay, anyway. Desert island piece of any genre?
Ooh. Sorry. I think I would take, for some reason, two albums are popping into my head. John Coltrane Ballads, mm-hmm. just the trio recordings, mm-hmm. and Marvin Gaye, Mercy, that album.
Mm-hmm. I want to be on your island. Sounds like an awesome island.
Got a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
Oh, I guess. There's some nice string action in those Marvin Gaye tunes.
Sure. Nice. Okay. You finished the surefire questions. Congratulations. I can't finish it. I'm sorry, Ravel. All right, Ravenna, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you discover the violin? When did you know that that was going to be something you're pursuing professionally? And all the steps along the way to where you are today.
Okay, I was born on a beautiful... No, I'm kidding. My mom is a cellist, principal cellist at the Milwaukee Ballet Orchestra, and Baroque cellist, actually, gamba player. So I started on the cello when I was 3. Mm-hmm. Because that's what she did. And I really hated my teacher. I think she was, you know, the best Suzuki teacher in the area. And she was probably just setting me up well. You know, I just remember hugging the cello and rocking back and forth.
Yes.
But you're 3 years old. So you want to make sound.
Yeah.
So I was already a little like, ugh, annoyed about going to lessons and just rocking back and forth for the whole time. And my mom was in a string trio at the time. So on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'd come home from kindergarten and they'd be rehearsing in the living room and I would hide behind our little rocking chair and watch them play. And the violinist, Pasquale, had the most expressive eyebrows I have ever seen. I was enraptured. Just whatever he was feeling, I needed to feel that.
Yeah.
Or whatever he was communicating that. So I asked my mom if I could switch, and she made me wait until I turned 4 to make sure I really meant it. Mm-hmm. And then I started Suzuki school in Milwaukee with Mimi Zweig, actually, who's mm-hmm. the big Suzuki lady mm-hmm. on campus. The whole time my mom was just waiting for me to get good enough to study with her friend Jerry Frankie.
Okay.
Who was associate concertmaster emeritus of the Milwaukee Symphony. And he said, if she can play a Mozart concerto, she can study with me.
Okay.
So every time we'd walk by his house on my way to school, he'd ask, Mozart concerto? Not yet. Book 5, blah, 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 whatever.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So finally, it was time and I got to go study. The moment came, 6th grade, I went to study with Jerry, and he ended up being one of the biggest influences on my life, I have to say. Because it wasn't just violin, it was also as a human being. Mm-hmm. Probably even my earliest mentor figure, mm-hmm. for sure. Mm-hmm. He had a very fuck them attitude mm-hmm. about things. Like, mm-hmm. everybody plays it this way. Play it this way! You know, like, excite them. Mm-hmm. Surprise them. Mm-hmm. Go crazy. Mm-hmm. He used to have this exercise. He'd say, pretend I'm deaf. Mm-hmm. And I have to know exactly what you want to say on the violin. Because, mm-hmm. you know, I was like an awkward little thing. So in myself, he wanted to bring it out of me.
Right.
And he also had these brilliant practice patterns and notes. He took like the main student concerti, Lalo, Mendelssohn, Bruch, etc. Mm-hmm. And he had different stages of practice patterns for the difficult passages. Mm-hmm. Really brilliantly laid out. Mm-hmm. And there's actually a doctoral student in Virginia who just wrote his entire thesis on Jerry's
life. Oh, that's cool.
And these exercises. So hopefully they'll be published and people will know more about them.
Yeah.
Loved Jerry very much. But I was a terrible student. I loved him. I loved him and I wanted to make him happy. I never played better than when I was playing for Jerry. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it was. He just made me feel free to be, oh, kitty.
Sorry. Oh, yeah, Sushi. Sorry.
Hi, Sushi. But I didn't really take it seriously. I was, you know, like always a concertmaster in youth orchestra or whatever. So I was just chilling. I also, like, I played soccer and I did theater and I was on the swim team and I had a social life. Which sure. He hated.
Oh.
You know.
Oh, okay.
He wanted me to practice. Sure. No, he wanted me to practice.
Yeah, okay.
So it wasn't until I spent my junior year of high school abroad in France. Mm-hmm. And I enrolled at the local conservatoire there. And I was living with a host family that didn't like music.
Oh, that's so a problem.
So I'd say, okay, I'm going to practice. They'd say, but you did that yesterday.
Oh.
You know, or it's like, you're making too much noise. Okay, then I'll go to school and practice. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you're never home with the family. It was just this constant thing. And they wanted me to stop playing the violin for the year that I was in France. Mm-hmm. And of course, that just made me classic, like, no, now I'm going to play even more violin all the time. You know,
yeah.
It's just so predictable, textbook.
Uh-huh.
So there I had put in a chamber music group with a bunch of older boys. They were 25. I was 15, 16. They made that year for me.
Okay.
We played Fauré Piano Quartet, Torino. They took me under their wing. And being in a conservatory, like walking down halls filled with rooms of people practicing, mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. That was the year. And that experience was what really made me decide that I had to play chamber music. So I came home from France and spent my senior year desperately practicing.
Uh-huh. Did your mom, along the way, I mean, since she's known the path of music, did she ever caution you or warn you or not even, or just like prepare you for when you kind of came back from that experience?
No, I don't think she wanted my decision to be a musician to be affected in any way by her.
Okay, her experiences.
Opinion?
Yeah.
So while she did, like, she was useful on my first day of youth orchestra, for example, she was like, do not play your concerto during the break.
Oh, good. Yes. More people.
She was like, there. I know. She said, they're going to be kids playing their piece as loud as they can. Don't do it. Don't you do it. You know, or like when she was like, we have to get there 15 minutes early.
Yes.
I remember being incredulous. Mm-hmm. Why?
Yeah.
Why? Because that's what you do. Just the concept of being early is on time,
okay.
Or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was great. But if I didn't practice, the deal in the house, if I didn't practice, she wasn't going to pay to rent the violin.
I see.
As you're going up in sizes. She wasn't going to pay for lessons. So if I didn't practice, she physically took the violin out to the car. And this happened a couple times.
Okay.
I had to run out to the car crying, begging for her not to take my violin back to the shop.
Wow, that was effective. Yeah.
So at least. It was one of those things that I loved and was always a part of me, but I definitely took it for granted.
Mm-hmm. As you do. Absolutely. As a kid. I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now, you know, as I went through college and grad school and freelance life, she's always so interested in what I'm learning or what my teachers have said. You know, she's a teacher herself and she's one of the most dedicated musicians I know. Mm-hmm. Just every day without fail, she loves to practice. Mm-hmm. She loves to explore and question and, you know, any little nuggets I would give her you're embarrassing me. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, she loved. And she's been incredibly helpful. Just kind of general advice for audition prep or, you know, she lived in New York for 12 years. So there's some familiarity with the life that I'm living. But also life now in New York is very different.
Totally.
So it's been
a generation later.
Yeah.
Okay. So then you practiced a lot in high school and then I know you went to SFCM after that, San Francisco Conservatory of Music.
I did. I got into Eastman and San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And
well, I'm glad you went to San Francisco.
Believe it or not, San Francisco gave me more money.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I remember the audition process being so crucial in my decision.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about prestigious names of conservatories. Like for a mother who went to Juilliard and Yale, mm-hmm. she did not glorify conservatories or anything.
That's amazing.
Like that. It was very much like, you're going to play for a couple different teachers who are recommended to you by your teacher. And if you like that person, then go for that. She also did. She happened to know. She went to school with a lot of the San Francisco faculty.
Okay.
So when she read that Axel was there and saw who else was on faculty, she was very on board.
Yeah. Because they're all her friends.
Clearly.
I get that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the audition process, it was, oh, do you remember what his name was? Alex.
like curly hair.
I wish I could remember. Yes. He was there at my regional audition in Chicago, and he was so lovely and so kind, and I felt like I played so well in that audition. And then I went to Rochester for the Eastman audition, and it was the entire violin faculty and the dean of students and two video cameras in this tiny room, and I was squished up against a piano, and nobody smiled at me when I walked in the door.
Oh, that is such a familiar audition scene.
Oh, my gosh. I was like, why do I want to go to school here?
Right.
Even though I know plenty of people who have been to Eastman and love it, and but no, just in that space where I was as a 17-year-old, I was an easy choice.
You had that perception for yourself.
So yeah, so San Francisco, man, San Francisco was really just a golden period. It's kind of, sometimes I get a little, not lonely. I love my New York, my East Coast people, but people who have been on the West Coast who are in San Francisco kind of around that time just know.
Yeah.
They just know how special it really, really was.
Yeah.
For all of its, you know, faults as well.
Oh, totally. It wasn't perfect.
Yeah.
But it was so close.
It was
close.
Not perfect. Yeah. But I felt like I mattered there. We were special. We were individuals. We were allowed to contain all of our multitudes, and that is what helped us be great musicians. You know, we were seen as human beings. Also, just having access to the faculty, like we did, playing all that chamber music with them. They were so generous. Oh, I loved it. And, you know, it's like your first time really living alone and having San Francisco as your playground, essentially. Just shenanigans galore. No, it was incredible. And then grad school.
Yeah, I remember when you were auditioning because we were in Trio 507 together at that point.
Yes.
Can I, can I spill, like,
go for it,
that you were, like, upset that you got into Juilliard?
Was I upset?
Yes, you were upset. Was you? Yes. It's just funny because I think you really wanted to go to NEC or something.
Yeah.
And which is, I mean, both are incredible schools with incredible faculty. But I just thought it was funny because it's like, wait, what? Why are you, you know, I mean, I get it. I get it at the same time.
I'm trying to break down that reaction now.
Yeah.
And like understand really where it was coming from.
I think it was, again, maybe the school reputation and environment.
Yeah. I didn't want to be one of those kids.
Right.
But that's, that was my own weird baggage, not wanting to go where my mom had been.
Right.
This is turning into a real mommy podcast. I'm so sorry.
No, it's,
I probably, like, therapy sense, is wonderful. And
it makes sense because, like, your mom, you inherited so much of her story as a kid, you know, like, there's so much of that that it makes sense.
Yeah. But Axel ultimately was like, you have to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I still remember that first week in Juilliard walking down the halls, like smiling at people, as you do.
Yeah.
Because
that's what we did at SFCM.
That's what we did at SFCM. And chances were you knew the person anyway because there were only 400 of us or something.
Yeah.
But nobody looked me in the eyes.
Oh, wow.
Everybody's faces were down and I did not matter at all. So that was kind of a shock. But I loved Mr. Copes. My teacher, and I was working with Joel Krosnick a lot for chamber music because I had met him at Kneisel Hall the summer before. Yeah, so that master's degree kind of blew by.
I know, it's only two years. It's
it's only 2 years, you're there, and then just as you feel you kind of get the hang of things, it's done.
Yeah.
So I was super burnt out though by the end, going straight from San Francisco into a master's program. After I graduated, I think I didn't touch a violin for a month. Easy.
Yeah.
And then one day I started practicing, and I had also, my plan was never to stay in New York. I was like, okay, I'm going to finish Juilliard and I'm going to get the hell out of here. So I started applying to all these auditions outside of the States. And I ended up winning an associate concertmaster trial with Royal Scottish National Orchestra at the same time as I was invited as a finalist to go to New Zealand and play with the New Zealand String Quartet. So I said no thanks to the orchestra job and went to New Zealand for 4 weeks. And that was amazing. And it was incredible. And it just kind of reaffirmed after my, you know, post-grad school burnout that yes, I do love this lifestyle. I love traveling. I love rehearsing. I love this repertoire. Mm-hmm. I just didn't love the people.
Sure. And that's a huge part. Well, I mean, it's not even a person. It's not even like you're saying anything about them. It's just that, like, if personalities don't click, then, you know, it makes that music making so much more difficult.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they were all lovely. And the quartet's been together for over 40 years, mm-hmm. which is incredible with only maybe a handful of personnel changes as well. Mm-hmm. They have their market cornered. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what they do. They're a terrific group. Mm-hmm. Really cool projects, but not enough to merit moving across the world.
Yeah, away from family.
Away from everything. And it wasn't until I was there that I realized everything, like all the little seeds I had unknowingly planted in New York that were starting to kind of come to fruition. And I kept feeling a pull to come back here and see those through.
Yeah.
Outside of the stressful school environment. Mm-hmm. So I did. Mm-hmm. I came back to New York and I had my groups and I freelanced and I traveled and played all over. And
when did the turn?
The pandemic.
Yeah. Well, I was going to just ask, when did the turn to historical performance happen? I mean, I know you've always been interested in it because San Francisco is also a hub for the historical performance scene as well, music scene. But
yeah,
New York's a huge one. And also the program, the historical performance program at Juilliard, I forget what year it started, the endowment kicked in. But
I should know this.
Well, I mean, it was within our times as students. It wasn't like it's been there forever. Yeah.
It was something, it was like 2009 or something. 2010.
Right.
Something like that.
Yeah.
One of the ways I definitely shot myself in the foot was by actively avoiding historical performance while at San Francisco.
Sure.
Because, of course, my mother was like, this would be so helpful. I think you'd really love it. Uh-huh. I think you'd be good at it. Right. And so, of course,
no.
I had to say, no way, Mom. But when I got to Juilliard, they offer free secondary lessons if you're interested. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, let's see what this is all about. And I started studying with Robert Neely, and he put me in a tour with J415, which is the name of the historical performance orchestra ensemble. And we toured kind of the southern United States with St. Matthew Passion.
Awesome.
And that was my first HP performance experience. And, well, okay, talk about transformative performance experiences. That was a game changer.
Yeah.
And then from there, they kept hiring me to come back and sub with 415 when they needed violins. And some of the people I met through doing that in the program continued to hire me for projects outside of school. Mm-hmm. So at least a couple times a year, I was still playing Baroque violin.
Yeah.
But, you know, always feeling like an imposter. Mm-hmm. I'm a good mimic. You know, if I hear something, I can usually make it happen on the fiddle, even if I don't really know why or how or the most efficient way to do it. So the pandemic hit, and, you know, everybody was reflecting and thinking about all the things that were exploding in the world at the time.
Yeah.
And I was sitting with this sort of duality, that the realization that the playing that was making me the happiest was the historical performance playing. Mm-hmm. The Baroque playing. It made me feel sparkly, you know, and stimulated and creative because of the same things we were talking about why we love Mark.
Right.
Intention and character and a sort of freedom and a full embodiment of the music that you're playing. Mm. But then reconciling that with the fact that these are all dead white guys.
Sure.
And I don't feel comfortable dedicating my entire life to sort of worshiping at this altar that very clearly does not need to be there anymore.
Right.
And as I was thinking about these things, considering applying for the program, because what else was I going to do in a pandemic? And I got offered a spot with the Overlook Quartet, which was formed during the pandemic, and they met outdoors to read music by overlooked voices, essentially. Mm-hmm. Women, Black composers, composers of color, and amassing this incredible repertoire of this music that we think deserves to be in the quote-unquote canon. Mm-hmm. I hate that term. Like, let's be done with the canon.
Yeah.
But whatever, like the classics, there's so much amazing repertoire, old and new and contemporary. So it seemed ideal timing that as I was starting to find this new way that I love to play and express myself, this other opportunity came along to provide context and balance to what I was doing. So I decided to do, obviously, I'm in the historical performance program.
Yeah.
Trying to defeat my imposter syndrome.
Sure.
There.
Well, anything that you're going to learn from that program is going to translate into whatever music making you make in any other ensemble too. I mean, it's like, it's all just sources of inspiration as well.
Absolutely.
Even if they happen to be pieces written by dead white male composers. I mean,
it's true.
Everything is in context is historic. You can't change history. You can't change who were elevated to that level of being able to compose and write music, mm-hmm. or what was preserved even.
The cool thing now is that not nearly enough as there could be, but resources are starting to be allocated to dig up more lesser known mm-hmm. composers of the Baroque period or before. Mm-hmm. For example, like Jewish music mm-hmm. of the Baroque time. Mm-hmm, right. Rosenmuller is a very standard name, but he's just one. And there are multiple scholars who are kind of delving into this sort of aspect. So we're actually starting to have a more multifaceted view of what Baroque music was, and not just what was maintained by the courts or the rich people.
Or the Christian church, even.
Right. Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's an interesting time to be around.
Definitely. So you also said that you're part of a contemporary ensemble.
Yeah. So Acme.
So you're like, I mean, people say you dip your toes in lakes, but like your toes are all over the place. Like.
Oh, man, maybe I should update my Tinder bio.
Your toes.
Roll with my
toes.
You'll
get some foot fetishes there.
Oh, exactly. Oh, no, maybe I should start an OnlyFans for my toes. No, sorry, PG. Keep it PG. Yes, Acme. That's also sort of an early New York. I kind of fell into that group, was recommended for a recording session, and then it just stuck.
Yeah.
I love playing with them. We kind of have a rotating roster of different people, but it's the same reasons I love historical performance. And the same reasons I love, it really just boils down to commitment to the music that you're performing.
That's true.
No matter what it is.
Your true artistic value is conviction within the music and how to get that zest again kind of thing. Yeah.
Zest. Yeah.
Get that lemon.
I mean, because then what's the point? What's the point?
Right.
If you're not, but you're right. You only have so much energy. You have so many personal resources and something's got to give at some point. But if the general standard is.
Right.
Like as soon as someone starts talking about how something is boring.
Not interesting.
I can't help but question that.
Yeah.
Like, maybe, but you should still be finding a way to be present and engaged. Because I've heard amazing performances of Drones. And I think a lot of people would say, like, oh, man, I have to hold this open D forever. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, but what life is happening within that time and space? Mm-hmm. I've never forget. Ian came to visit New York, and he had me sign him in. Oh, I remember I was going to bed, and he texted me. He was like, scales in the morning? I was like, oh, God. Sure, Ian. He's like, okay, see you at school, 7:30. Yeah. I was like, oh, God. So I meet him at school and we go into an empty dance studio and we're like playing slow scales and then, you know, Bach and like rolling around on the floor. Uh-huh. And he said, how much can you hear in a split second of time?
Yeah.
There is so much that happens.
Yes.
It's a very intense way to live.
I mean, that's Ian for you though, but yeah.
It's an intense way to live, but it's the best. But it's so true. And even in moments in orchestra rehearsal, for example, where we're tired or we've been playing the same shit over and over, whatever, if I use that all the time and pull myself back in, I'll be like, okay, focus truly just like moment to moment and see how much there is to hear, everything that's really going on.
Mm-hmm. But what I take from that is that that's what music is to us, is slowing down time and like opening up these moments that we take for granted and macro scale them and really truly live in that moment. Mm. And that's when the most exciting performances, well, that's what I at least strive for in my most exciting performances, is expanding this time that we take for granted on a second to second basis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing because you look at, well, even a painting, you look at a beautiful painting and if it's really compelling, your eyes want to take in every detail.
Yeah.
Every stroke, every aspect, every line.
That's why I feel like Van Gogh is so popular. It's because of that very reason, right?
Mmm.
Yeah. Other than just...
That's like, absolutely true.
Yeah. Colors and...
It being, like, good or and pretty.
People telling you that you should like Van Gogh. Yeah. Like,
right. Yeah. Our eyes are so much more adept and comfortable at being confronted with things that they've never seen before. Mm-hmm. And I think ears...
take more time.
Ears take more time. You know, even if you go to a contemporary art museum and someone put white paint on a white canvas and you think, Well, I could have done that. Well, first of all, you didn't.
Right.
They did.
Right.
And second of all, even looking at that white paint on that white canvas offers shades of white and texture on the can. You know, there's just a universe within everything.
Right.
Quant said it best. I think about this a lot too. He said, you know, talking about like mezzo di voce and the bow stroke being like a bowl, but it's every note should have its forte and piano respectively. Mm. Like every note should have its life, a full life, no matter what that life is. Within the note. And, okay, I'm done with my, like, with my hippy-dippy ranting.
I know, but the thing is, I'm like, I'm all about this. I'm like, oh, I miss this. Oh, my gosh.
I know.
I'll say, it wraps up a little bit, I mean, that's one of the things I always remember about what Mark Sokol would say, is every note matters. Every note's life matters. If you throw it away, you're losing the purpose behind that little dot of ink on a piece of paper. I mean, not to be like, then why are we living? That's not what I mean, but just like, but you know, but that's like, but that's the nerdy stuff that just like, yeah, that's the art behind it. You know, at least to me, that's why we're talking right now. Because it gets us all excited.
Exactly.
Yeah. But anyway, shall we take a break? Because we could just keep spiraling and this will become the Joe Rogan experience. Okay.
Oh, God. Okay. Break.
All right. We'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So tell me about how you got into bouldering. I had no idea that can you even do that in New York City?
Yeah. We got a couple bouldering gyms knocking around. I got into it. Mandy, my neighbor and friend, started doing it. Her ex-girlfriend was into it. Just word of mouth. Mm-hmm. And they had just opened a new gym relatively close to my apartment in Harlem.
Okay.
And they were having some promotional deal. So I went, and I'm just notorious for having no upper body strength. I'm a low down Eastern European peasant build. Squat. Close to the earth. Grounded.
Yes.
Not meant for climbing trees.
Okay.
In fact, I did not climb trees as a child. To my great shame, I wasn't a climber. Yes. But I decided that now is the time. And I went. And it was awesome because it's the perfect introverted extrovert, or like extroverted introverts sport.
Okay.
So I love, it's a singular activity. It's you on the wall.
Right.
But there are still people around you also focused on doing their own thing. So
but it's not like a team sport.
It's not a team sport. So I appreciate the social element. I am a social creature, but I want to do my own shit. I'm sorry, Sushi just popped up behind you as I said that. Just totally dead facing the window. That was amazing. I want to do my own shit. Boom. Cat.
Yeah.
And it's problem solving at its essence. I mean, it is like a physical feat, obviously, of strength. But to understand body weight distribution, energy saving positions, how, like, the most efficient, smart way to get up to the top of the wall. It's so great. I feel like it exercises all of me.
Right. Well, it is a full body experience.
It's a full body experience, mental and physically.
Okay. So bouldering is different than your average rock climbing wall? Am I understanding this correct? I mean, I kind of know what bouldering is from just like bouldering in Colorado or like random places like that.
Yeah. But so bouldering, I think the main defining characteristic is you don't have a rope. You're not hooked on to anything. Whereas lead climbing, which I think a lot of people do, you're in the harness. And you climb up to the top of the wall, and then you can bounce your way back down with someone belaying you.
Yes. Okay. But then what about, like, Free Solo, like that movie?
Bouldering.
So he was bouldering the whole time. Oh, my gosh. That's
when you get up to some of the – I just watched The Alpinist. Have you seen that? Mm-mm. Oh, I recommend it. It's amazing. It's incredible.
Okay.
But I think when he was kind of charting out some of his huge, massive climbs, or he would bring his girlfriend along, who was also a phenomenal climber but not quite his level, they would use a harness just to kind of save energy and mark out the path, and then he would go and do it without any of the ropes.
Yikes.
That's insane. That's crazy.
Yeah.
I feel like a badass doing my little indoor bouldering, but that's just it's wild. Well, it's the places that humans are not meant to go.
And they go.
And they go. It's incredible.
And they somehow don't die, hopefully.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
So that's going to be my question. When you're going to this gym to boulder, do you have to sign a waiver, or like, is there any risk of death? Really? Okay.
I mean,
Yes, everybody has to sign a waiver. The first thing they do is teach you how to fall. The ground is
how do you fall?
On your back, and then you roll, tuck and roll.
Okay.
It's fun. I fall all the time.
When you were learning how to fall, did you literally have to like climb up and then drop yourself and do it? That kind of
No, I mean from maybe from like I would step up just a couple inches. They just showed you and you just demonstrated rolling onto your back. But the first couple falls are really scary. Even though you're not that high up, you're maybe maximum in this gym, maximum 15, 20 feet up.
That's what would scare me though.
It feels weird, but then you realize it's okay. Like you're fine. You're going to land on a super squishy mat. Maybe if your foot slips or something, if it's not a clean fall, like if you're not at the top and just dropping off, I've shredded my arms a little bit, scraping it on parts, but it's fine.
Yeah.
It's all been good. And it's been super helpful with violin. I was also worried about my arms.
Well, right. So, I mean, I think that's where a lot of people, myself included, have shied away from doing any rock climbing because I didn't know if I was going to put too much tension on my forearms or my fingers, my wrists, et cetera, et cetera. So debunk that maybe or?
Well, in the beginning, my forearms got super tight. In the moment you're climbing, when you don't know how to use support
your legs.
I love dancing. I'm played soccer. Like I'm in my body. Like I understand, I feel my body and I have a pretty good sense mind body connection. But this has me using my body in a way that feels very foreign. So for the first couple weeks, you're trying to do most of the work with your arms when really it should be your legs. So there's an in-between period where you're figuring that out. And it's still like your forearms are going to get sore, but it's nothing compared to like years of repetitive stress damage that we give ourselves. Like any musician knows what to do if your forearm feels a little tight. You ice it, you have your balms for it, and then it's fine. Usually I like to do it before I have a rehearsal because if anything, the violin feels really easy after hauling my ass up a wall.
Yeah.
And you do. The strength is real. It strengthens your entire back, which is so beneficial. And I avoid anything finger crimping where you just really are placing all the weight on your fingers. That's dangerous.
But that's also part of like more advanced rock climbing, if I understand correctly. Mm-hmm. Using a lot of finger strength and like or even putting your hand in to be kind of that.
Oh my God. Yes.
Nook in the wall or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. No, I don't. I'm not nearly that good yet. Yeah. I'm starting to come up against it where I have to either like tap out of one or know that I can't do it. But the other great part about it is I've had to truly discard this perfectionist classical music mentality.
Oh, so hard to do.
It's really hard to do. And also, I'm trying to say this without sounding like an asshole, but I can usually grasp ideas and concepts and just things quickly. Once, you know, like I'm quick. I'm smart. Mm-hmm. I can say that.
Yeah, you're a quick study.
Yeah, I'm a quick study. But with bouldering, it is not a quick process. You can't fight your own body makeup or gravity. So even getting one hold higher than I had gotten is a win.
Right.
And you have to be just really take it. And it's like your body, you may not have had enough sleep the night before. You may not have had enough protein, whatever has happened.
Factors.
That's who you are on the wall and you got to work with it. Mm-hmm. You got to deal with it. And it's okay. That's the other thing. It's like you don't have to send every problem the first time, every time.
Well, that's also like, why don't we say that for ourselves when we walk on stage?
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some of us who are a little wiser do, but...
Or try every now and then. Yeah. Well, and I've noticed when I go alone versus when I go with friends, as much as I love going with my friends because the hang is fun, but I am not in the right headspace. I end up not being able to send problems that I did by myself the day before. Just because when I'm by myself, there's some sort of patient, I'm present, I'm really just like calmly thinking things out and feeling. Instead of being around people and feeling like, we're all climbing now. Okay, you climb now. Okay, but you better do it right because all these people are here watching you climb, which is so dumb. You know, like, I shouldn't say dumb. I'm not allowed to speak ill of my own thoughts. They're there. Okay. Sorry. My therapy is showing. I think we all feel that way to a certain extent. But again, it's the same in performance. If you're out there trying to play because there are people there to watch you play, it's not going to be a connected, moving performance.
Yeah. I mean, is there an element of meditation when you are climbing? That, again, it's this idea with the EN second of it expanding time in a way
for
yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. And the other thought I had was when you are bouldering and climbing, what you're thinking about is the longer trajectory of where you're going. Like a musical phrase, you're not necessarily, you're like taking little steps, but you're really trying to plan out a longer directional path to take.
Absolutely. And it's amazing when you realize, I try to videotape myself. Again, I will videotape myself bouldering and it's like pulling teeth to get me to videotape myself playing the violin, even though I know it will be so helpful.
Right. Yeah.
But I videotape myself.
So why do you No, please go on.
Why do I? Well, because you can see, if I go back and rewatch a climb that I just did, I can see, okay, I'm wasting too much energy sitting here. If I allow the momentum to carry me up to this hold, this will be easier. Instead of sitting somewhere and having to recreate the impulse to get up. It's like a musical phrase. It's like, why are you letting drop here and then having to carry it? It's amazing how clear that becomes.
Wow, I never would have, I never would have thought that that's like something that you could gain from bouldering.
I didn't either, but I'm super into it. Plus, it's a dog-friendly gym, so you just...
Oh, cool.
And rest, that's the other thing. You have to rest. Rest time is so important, otherwise you burn out your arms and you can't do anything.
Right.
So really valuing rest as a part of the practice. And knowing that, okay, I will rest now, and then I will have more strength and a higher chance of being able to send this problem. It's still with the violin. It's like, why am I practicing and practicing and practicing the same thing for an extended amount of time? When really what my brain needs is to step away for a second, decompress, and then come back with fresher ears or fingers or whatever have you.
Okay, so I have a question about that because, sure, similar in violin or musician practice, we practice a lot, or if we've decided to put the instrument down and do something else, I personally, sometimes my brain is still processing. It's still practicing.
Yeah.
It's just not at the instrument, right? Or I'm listening to recordings, or I'm considering other things and how that's going to influence what I do in tomorrow's practice or tomorrow's rehearsal, et cetera, or performance. Mm-hmm. So my question is, do you do that? Is there any kind of either passive or active thinking that you do for bouldering? Or is that just simply like, that's the time at the gym is their time at the gym, and then that's, you've like cut it out?
Oh, you mean when I'm away from the gym thinking about rock climbing?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I think I leave it there.
Okay.
Unlike music. I mean, during my rest time in between climbs, I am actively thinking about how to solve problems or body positioning or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think because it's the time away from thinking about music or thinking about quote unquote real life, I leave it there because I want that to be its special place.
Yeah. I mean, that's also like, you don't have to
actively
be thinking about it all the time.
I think it's a healthy obsession. I think about how much I want to go climbing a lot. But I'm not, and I follow climbers on Instagram. So I do, like, I'm watching and I'm observing and passively thinking about things, but I'm not, it's not on the back burner of my mind at all times.
How do you prepare yourself to go rock climbing?
It's super chill. Yeah, that does. I literally have my tote bag with my climbing shoes and chalk bag, and that's all you need.
Okay. I mean, you don't have like a, you know, today I'm going to do a light ascent, but I'm really preparing for tomorrow's, you know, et cetera.
Oh, that kind of thing. No. I try to go every 2 days. And again, I think it's so much more a practice of being present for me. I don't want to put pressure on myself to be good at it, because that's natural with everything that I'm going to try. I want to be good at it. And this is because I'm not inherently good at it. It's good for me. It's very humbling.
Yeah.
And I want to stay climbing away, whatever that means for me. It's been a good tool for that.
Yeah. Do you have any plans to take it outside of the gym?
Yeah, not anything extreme. There are actually a couple spots in Central Park where they have sort of established boulder routes. And when, I mean, it's cold as...
I know.
But when it's a little warmer and there's not snow and ice everywhere, I definitely want to go check those out.
Okay, and so, sorry, can you remind me when you started bouldering?
August.
Okay, so it's like very recent.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you feel that you are, like, in ways that you are progressing?
Absolutely. I could barely stay on the wall when I started, and there's a numbering system, like V0 is the easiest, V10 is the hardest, and I'm up to, like, starting V2s now.
Okay.
Which is...
That's significant.
It's kind of surprising how quickly the strength is built. Uh-huh. So much in the beginning is just getting that base level of strength up. Mm-hmm. And then the more you learn how to position your body in advantageous, energizing ways.
Well, that also makes sense to how we learn our instruments to begin with. Absolutely. There's so much baby stuff. Yeah, like fundamentals that you learn, and everything else is finessing that technique.
Yep, yeah. Absolutely.
I know, everything's sports, full circle.
I know.
Well, I am looking forward to watching your bouldering journey as you continue. It's very exciting to hear that you're getting into that. And yeah, I wish I was in New York to do it with you.
Aww, me too. I'm sure they have bouldering gyms in Minnesota.
Oh, they definitely do. Oh, there's Vertical Horizons here and stuff like that. Yeah. Maybe. I want to, maybe once my Beethoven cycle's over.
Oh, yeah. Fair enough. Save your strength. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Can I ask you two final questions?
Absolutely.
What is one piece of advice you would tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
The hard-hitting questions, Patty.
I know. Sorry.
No, it's great. I would say your own standards are the most important.
That's huge. That's a great response.
Yeah. We're so conditioned to grovel for approval from teachers and colleagues and peers, but only you really
can seek acceptance almost, you know?
Yeah. That too. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't need to, I think it's pretty clear.
Yeah, that's great.
If you're doing yourself proud, then
that's all you can ask for.
Doesn't matter. Yep.
Yeah. All right. And my second question, as we continue through a weird pandemic world, what elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue, and what would you want to shed?
Ooh, that's good. I'm tired of taking gigs for the sake of being busy.
Yes.
So that's...
I've started to say no to a lot more gigs than I probably would have before the pandemic.
Yeah. I feel more comfortable living with sort of financial insecurity in that sense, because things always do work out. So learning to trust my own safety net, as it were. So that definitely out the window. And something to keep, two things. One would be the realization that, and I've had this, obviously this, I know this, but it's something I have to keep rediscovering. Practicing brings me joy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's
weird to say that, though.
I know.
It's like, but it's so true.
Because
at least for people like us.
Yeah. And it's always the first thing to go. When I have depression, anxiety, and when I'm feeling low or anxious, the violin is the first thing to go away. Mm-hmm. When really it is the one thing that will make me feel more like a human. And even as far as in the pandemic, like just taking up time, being able to lose myself in that and not having to have a reason, not being like, I have to learn this music for something, just because I enjoy the process of exploration on the instrument. Yeah. So I want to keep that. And then on like a side thing, I started learning electric bass, and it's so much fun. And
oh, cool.
It's been really helpful just for like ear training stuff, having to listen at these low frequencies.
Welcome to our world.
Oh, yes. I'm so jealous you guys have this already built in.
Well, it's not even like listening to those wave frequencies, it's like feeling it. Like my whole body is like
resonating.
Yeah,
it's awesome. I started playing viola because everybody has to play viola in HP, so I've been playing a bunch of Baroque viola. So much fun having a C string. Get out of here. Oh, I would trade my E string for a C string. And well, I shouldn't say that because I do love the violin too.
Yeah, right. You just want, can you just have a six string? Wait, no, five string. Wait,
five.
I don't know how many strings are. Can you just have a five-stringed, violin, viola, hybrid?
That'd be dope.
That whole thing would be like, how big would that instrument
I've actually, I've played a five-string before. It's trippy. Oh, yeah. All the
Does
spaces.
Does it even sound good?
Your left hand is just confused about what is... What goes where?
Yeah. What string is where?
And it's heavy.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense.
But it's cool. The guy who, he was really good at it. He could play it. He's a jazz violinist, had a five-string violin.
Very cool.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. All right. Ravenna, are there any platforms or websites for our listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
I'm on the gram.
Yeah.
It's just Ravenna Lipchick.
Okay.
I think I have a Twitter account, but I only really use it to yell at the U.S. Postal Service. Okay. Always messing with my packages, man. Or the Overlook Quartet. We have an Instagram. Our website is in progress.
Okay.
So we'll be playing at Mass Mocha, actually on April 2nd, as mm-hmm. part of their Slow Art Day full installation. So that's really exciting, collaborating with the curator, visual artist in residence, and playing some of our own stuff. So that's fun.
Yeah.
And then I'll be, well, hopefully supposed to be in Europe, supposed to be in Amsterdam at the end of April for a tour, but...
So any international listeners, cross your fingers that maybe you can see Ravenna there.
Amsterdam in April, point. Germany in May. We'll see. Again. Okay. This could all be canceled, so
right.
The gram is the safest.
Let's hope not.
Yeah, knock on wood.
All right, and if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of its crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day, and it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Hidden Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/HaydenMusicStand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is at HaydenMusicStand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, HaydenMusicStand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries. There's a Spotify playlist with all the music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the description of each episode. Thank you so much, Ravenna, for joining me today.
Thank you, Patty. My pleasure.
I'm giving you a huge hug from afar.
I miss you
dearly.
Zoom hugs. I miss you too.
Yeah. I can't wait until the next time we can visit each other.
Be in the
to Lakes same area
place.
Or whatever.
I am.
Yeah.
I'll be there.
Okay. That day will come.
We'll go climbing.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. I don't know how to prepare for that, but I'll do something. And thanks for listening. Sushi, say bye.
Wait, that'd be hilarious on the harmonica. The harmonies would just be...
I don't...
Can we try it?
Well, my harmonica's tuned in C. I don't know how to do it.
Okay.
No, yeah, I don't know if it's going to work.
That's what I mean. It's going to end up being...
Well, it was worth the shot. I guess I should inhale, though. Wait, like.
That's a great example of, remember when we were working on the opening of Ghost?
Yes.
And Mark, had you played, you have to, you, what did you land on a high B?
In the
what's the note that the cello da
da da dee F sharp F sharp so like yada yam bum 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 F
that's an F sharp thank you sorry
F sharp yeah
and he was like well what if that wasn't the note you landed on
right
do you remember he like his exercise of oh I love that
oh of course what if oh wow I buried that one too that was great. Oh my gosh.
What if the composer hadn't written what they wrote? What if Ravel had written Ravel Trio for the harmonica?
Oh, Jesus. I'm really glad he wrote it for the piano trio. Wow, I forgot about that. See, he had those little nuggets that were so good.
I know.
Yeah.
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 It's nice when they bubble to the surface.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.